Never in the history of the broadcasting media has the morale standard of a newscaster been lower. Here comes the Colonel.
It's not funny. It's just not funny. All right, you guys, where do you get these people? Just tell me, where do these people come from anyway?
All right, welcome back to second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow, here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. Yes, I am. I'm Colonel Mason, and we're going to check in this half hour with Kenneth Reed. He's found a very practical use for that pioneering Kodak technology that gave us these wonderful photographs all these years until we finally pushed it aside and have gone to all digital photography. Ken is going to also tell us about how he developed what he calls the smallest particle, 2.5 nanometers wide. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. Also, if you just tuned in, I want to alert you to the International Conference on Nanotechnology, August 15th and 18th in Portland, Oregon. This traveling conference goes around the world, and we get it now in Portland. And you can find out more information at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz, the right-hand side of the screen. Just scroll down. You'll find the link. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set to answer today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
I see we've summoned the spirit of the fountain. Okay, little spirit of the fountain, here's an easy one for you. What's the closest G2 spectrum yellow dwarf to Earth? The closest G2 spectrum yellow dwarf. What's the closest one to Earth?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell the others.
Yeah, I told you that was an easy one. Everybody figured that one out. The closest G2 spectrum yellow dwarf to Earth? That's our sun. Our very own sun. All right, back to our programming. And right now we're going to check in with Ken Reed. He's Vice President and CTO of Sirian Enterprises, who rescued a lot of that pioneering Kodak technology and putting it to practical use. Welcome to the program, Ken.
Thank you very much, Colonel. I'm glad to be on.
I'm kind of glad that all that stuff with Kodak has not gone to waste now that there's digital. And I understand you've used a lot of the things that you learned when you were at Kodak in developing other things, and then you started Sirian Energy. And tell us about what you're doing with this nanoparticle, this 2.5 nanometer particle, and how you developed that.
Well, you're right. We built on the DNA of Eastman Kodak, where we do reactions in an aqueous reactor, in a water reactor, under the boiling point of water. And the interesting thing is we felt that if we took the material that's in your catalytic converter, which is cerium dioxide, it's also in your self-cleaning oven. If we took that material and if we could make it small enough, the particles small enough and had enough surface area, that it would actually work within the combustion chamber of an engine rather than, say, in a catalytic converter, where the gases spend much more time flowing over this material, of which you actually have about 75 grams or so. But your catalytic converter also uses precious metals like platinum and palladium and rhodium to increase the reaction of the cerium dioxide to oxidize your exhaust gases. Well, when you get these particles down to 2.5 nanometers, they become so reactive in the combustion chamber that you no longer need those precious metals. And in the burn cycle of a diesel engine, for example, which is only about 2 milliseconds, these crystals will rebalance the oxygen in the chamber and actually help the wave, the flame front propagate much faster and produce more energy that way. So this is one of the great advantages of nanotechnology, is that you can take a material in the bulk that has a certain properties, and just by making it very, very small, vastly change its color, its melting point, its chemical reactivity, a whole host of properties. So it's a way to engineer matter, basically. And at 2.5 nanometers, we've actually done calculations on these. That is 80, it's a crystal, like you're familiar with crystals, like sodium chloride crystals, salt crystals. Yeah. It's about 80 cerium atoms and 160 oxygen atoms. And to give you some scope and dimension, two of these crystals would fit across the DNA pairs of your DNA, basically, in every cell in your body. That's how small they are. And they can be imaged. We can actually look at these particles with a very powerful electron microscope. We use the one at Cornell University. Mm-hmm. And you can see rows of atoms and lattice planes. And with the electron beam, you can actually determine what atoms are in a plane and what their oxidation state is. And there's only about four of these powerful electron microscopes in the world. So we're fortunate to be kind of close to Ithaca, New York, and Cornell. So kind of in a nutshell, that's what we did. We went back to Eastman Kodak and we said, could we use your Building 35 to manufacture our particles? And they gave us a very attractive rental rate. And so we kind of moved back into Kodak, and we're one of 15 or so tenants in Eastman Business Park. Small startups like ours, doing various things.
Well, yeah, it's really good to know that the Kodak technology just didn't to go out the window when digital photography came about, and that all that technology that they developed for years and years and years, you're able to put to new use.
Well, when George Eastman first founded his company, and he was making photography accessible to the mass population back in the turn of the 20th century, in the 1900s, he was making small particles. So Rochester is one of the birthplaces of material science and nanotechnology, and now we're just kind of returning home to our roots. And instead of making photographic elements, we're making ceramic catalysts that buffer oxygen back and forth at very high rates, basically at the rate that the crystal is vibrating, which in the combustion chamber at about 750 degrees centigrade is 10 to the 12th per second. It's enormously rapid, but it's what crystals do when you heat them up.
So you've got all the equipment that you need right there in the old Kodak laboratories to turn out massive quantities of these particular crystals. Is that what we're to understand?
Yes, that's true. In just this 3 bays of Building 35 that we occupy, which is maybe only 7 or 8% of the building, we can treat 400 million gallons per month of diesel, which is about 12% or so of the U.S. total consumption. But we can expand our footprint in this large facility in Eastman Business Park. And, of course, we would also want to think about relocating or locating a facility maybe in Texas or Louisiana and maybe one in the West Coast or so, because of the ports and the use of diesel for transportation of barges and trains and so forth.
Well, Houston, of course, is an ideal place for that if you're going to be dealing in the energy business, because that's Energy Headquarters USA right there. And not only that, but I'm sure you know that there are many, many tax incentives that the state of Texas is offering to attract new businesses into Texas, including the Emerging Technology Fund and some other things. So I presume you've already investigated that.
We're aware of that, but we haven't started to expand yet. We're just building out our facility here at Rochester. And as I say, we're looking at alternative ways of making this. We make this in batch reactors, and there are ways of making this in a continuous reactor, which would give us much larger volumes. So Texas would be a very attractive state to locate in, and especially if there are incentives. But Texas is the energy state, right? I mean, you and Texas and Louisiana are one of the largest oil producers in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt about that. Of course, I sound like I work for the Texas Chamber of Commerce, and I don't. And I notice you've got a lot of support up there from your own congresspeople, Louise Slaughter, Democrat from New York. I understand, made a priority to fast track to the EPA approval for on the road use of your particular product. Is that right?
Yes, that is, Colonel Mason. We initially went after the off road market because it doesn't require EPA registration, and protocol for going through the EPA is quite lengthy, and it can be challenged by any number of engine producers with whom we're actually working, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, sure.
You know, as a startup company, we like to move rapidly and capture what opportunity we can initially, and then move into the larger on-road market, which, as you mentioned, Louis Slaughter is helping the dialogue between us and actually I talked with James Caldwell at the EPA. The on-road market for diesel is about 40 billion gallons per year in the U.S., and the off-road market's about 20 billion. So the off-road market is quite significant, but not as large as the on-road market. The attraction for us in off-road is it's an easier market to penetrate, and also there's a chance to clean up some of the ports, which are very dirty because of the boats that come in and the soot that they produce. So that's kind of the hierarchy of the way we're going at it.
Well, your initial testing has been with a regional rail customer, Finger Lakes Railway, and you've just finished analyzing their fuel usage. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what these crystals have done with the fuel usage for the railroad?
Well railroads are very large users of diesel. Typical railroad, and you know who they are, will burn a billion gallons of diesel a year, a billion and a half. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind now that every gallon of diesel that you burn produces 22 pounds of CO2, so there's a big incentive to reduce the amount of fuel they use just in terms of greenhouse gases.
Now, I have to stop you there. Did you say that every pound of diesel, every gallon of diesel that is burned produces 22 pounds of CO2? Is that correct?
Yes, if I've done my chemistry correct, it is, yes. It's of course, I mean, you're burning a hydrocarbon and you're making water and CO2. So it's a staggering amount of carbon dioxide. Yeah. So we started working with Finger Lakes Railroad, and what we did, it's a local regional railroad, we have these very expensive portable emissions monitoring systems, and what they do is they measure the CO2 coming out of the stack of the engine, and through an algorithm you can back calculate what the rate of fuel usage is. So we get a stable baseline with a diesel locomotive. I actually have some pictures of our scientists on the locomotive with these $250,000 portable emissions monitoring units, getting a baseline, because the Finger Lakes Railroad is a short line railroad and hauls pretty much the same stuff over the same route. And then after we get a stable baseline for fuel usage, we treat this the fuel under the belly tank of the train with our combustion catalyst, our fuel-borne additive, and let that go for a while until that reaches a stable baseline, and then we can differentiate the two. And they've been using this for about almost a year now, a little less than a year, and from January through March of this year, Finger Lakes Railroad burned 8.4% less fuel than the same time last year when they weren't using our fuel additive. There's kind of a funny story there, because when I initially looked at the numbers, I added up the columns and said, my gosh, they're burning more. And one of our scientists said, no, you added the wrong columns. You added the dollar cost. You didn't add the actual cost of the fuel. So even though we are saving them a substantial amount of fuel usage, as you know, from when you go to fill up your gasoline car, the cost of fuel has just skyrocketed. So it's an interesting proposition, this intersection of nanotechnology and the energy crisis, really.
Well, as you mentioned, you're also doing some things with navigable with navigation. I understand a tugboat company or something. Did you say?
Yes, we've worked with Miller's Launch in New York City Harbor, Staten Island, the Omni Warrior in Louisiana. Again, on our website, if you look, you'll see some of the reports. We typically see around 9% plus or minus 1.5% improvement in fuel economy, and about a 30% reduction in soot, and about a 12% reduction in CO2. Those tests are very conclusive because you have a starboard engine and a port engine, and so you put one of these expensive portable emissions monitoring units on each engine. One engine you treat and the other engine you don't treat.
Okay.
And then because you're taking the baseline in real time, all the nuisance variables like the load that the tugboat's pushing or the current or the wind or the pilots, how he's piloting the boat, all those nuisance variables go away and you're left with a very strong signal of treated versus untreated engine. Very powerful signal to noise there.
Okay.
You don't have to look at hundreds and hundreds of boats to, you know, do a statistical average. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's extremely compelling good statistical data.
Oh, that's fascinating stuff. Now, that I understand, though, that you're not stopping there. You're going to do jet fuels then next? Is that on the horizon soon?
Well, I'm not very familiar with turbines, and we would like to work with some manufacturers to see if we can help that process. That's a different process than a combustion, compression ignition engine. Our next goal really is to deal with some of these blue water boats that burn the very heavy bunker fuel.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, they have to start burning this 200 miles out from the coastline because the fuel is so dirty, they don't want to be burning that and releasing all those oxides of sulfur and things like that into a, you know, populated harbor. So that poses some interesting questions because this fuel is like heavy motor oil. It doesn't have the viscosity of diesel. In some cases, it's almost like the asphalt that's on your road surface. They have to heat it very hot to get it to flow. So there we're dealing with dosing systems in order to meter our product into the fuel, the heated fuel, just before it goes into the these very large, several thousand, 10,000 horsepower diesel engines. Very challenging problem, and there's a great deal of effort being put, scrutiny against the use of this heavy grade bunker fuel for ocean going ships because it is so dirty and polluting. So we're hopeful that we can help reduce those emissions also.
Well, that alone ought to make you very successful. But, of course, when you can get around to the gasoline engine and you can raise all of our gas mileage by 9 or 10%, you'll have a grateful public. There's no doubt about that.
I'll be grateful, too. Yeah, there's some self-serving interests there. Interesting thing is that diesel, the reason we went into diesel is because it's a compression ignition engine, and they operate it relatively low RPM and have very high torque.
Mm-hmm.
When you get into a gasoline engine, you pre-mix the fuel in the air, and instead of a 2 millisecond burn cycle, it's a quarter of that. So you've got a very short reaction time to make things happen. For me, as a scientist, that means I have to make these crystals operate even more efficiently, give up more oxygen. That's the thermodynamics. Make it give up the oxygen faster. That's the kinetics. Learn how to put things on the surface to help break bonds. We've mapped that out, and we think we can do it. We have to get to a reactivity that's about 8 times where we are now, 8 to 10 times that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's doable. We've seen in the lab. So, yes, a gasoline additive is on the horizon, but it's going to take us a little while to do the science and engineering behind that. But we're definitely focused in that direction.
And you're doing a bunch of other stuff too, I understand. You're dealing with what, therapeutics and developing nanoparticles that enable drug delivery chemistries for the treatment of diseases such as Parkinson's and multiple sclerosis and stroke and ALS. Can you tell us a little bit about that work that you're doing?
Yeah, well, let me try to give you some context. It looks like we've got some kind of magic elixir here, but what these crystals are in chemical parlance is they're an oxidation reduction catalyst. And what that means is a catalyst speeds up reactions. Doesn't change the endpoint or anything, but speeds up the reaction. And oxidation reduction to a chemist means you can either exchange oxygen atoms if you're at high enough temperature, and that's where the fuel additive works, or if you come down in temperature, you're actually moving electrons back and forth. And so these crystals have cerium plus four ions and plus three ions, so the plus four ions grab an electron and they get reduced to plus three. Well, in doing that, we found that these particles will destroy many of the free radicals in the body, actually in the brain, that cause some of these diseases you've alluded to. And so this is electrochemistry rather than combustion chemistry, but it fits within the definition of an oxidation reduction catalyst. And the way we're able to do this is, I told you that the particles are very small. They have a small charge on them, which is enough to keep them from sticking together. But then they're small enough to go through the capillaries in the brain, through the blood-brain barrier. Now, there are holes in those capillaries that are 4 nanometers, which allow glucose and oxygen and CO2 to exchange from into the brain and out, you know, so you have a metabolically healthy brain. And so our particles have just the right charge on them ionically to go through that barrier and then to destroy these free radicals, which in the case of multiple sclerosis, they'll scar the myelin sheath around the nerve ending that causes MS. So we've actually done this in live animal studies with mice that have been bred for MS. We induce the disease, the pathology, and then inject them with the particles. We actually inject them in the tail, and the particles travel to the brain. They then, but then we measure the function of the mouse. Believe it or not, I mean, put him on a little treadmill, see how long he can, or she can go on the treadmill. Or let them hang from a wire. So we try to measure the muscular strength, if you will, and we find in very controlled experiments with large numbers of animals that these particles will intercept the pathology of MS and actually allow the body to regenerate those endings and return the mouse's function back to normal. So it's just... it's amazing stuff. I mean, quite frankly, I'm awestruck too by the magnitude of this. And I think there's a really deep irony here when you think about some of the huge societal problems we face being tackled by some of the smallest things you can hardly image, even with powerful microscopes.
Yeah, no doubt. That's really pretty ironic, I guess. Ken Reed, the president, vice president, and CTO of Cerium Enterprises. You've been a delightful guest, and we certainly do appreciate you being with us today.
Well, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure also, Colonel Mason.
And now we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
There's a lot of good work going on. You know, high-tech research is a very interesting place to work, and you know, every day is interesting. So I would encourage people to get into any kind of high-tech field that makes them excited. I've been unable to convince my own son to go into a high-tech field, so I'm not sure I'm very qualified. He majored in international relations instead of engineering. It's great. It's a great place to be working and a great area of research to be doing. You know, if you're an aerospace engineering nerd like I am, it's really very interesting. I'm Marty Bradley, an engineer with the Boeing Company in the Boeing Research and Technology Organization.
So you decide, has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you. I